Welcome to the podcast of the European Society of Anesthesiology and Intensive Care. My name is Ulrike Stammer. I am an anesthesiologist working at the Department of Anesthesiology and Pain Medicine at the Inselspital Bern University Hospital, Switzerland. Today, we will talk about chronic post-surgical pain, CPSP. And therefore, we have invited Professor Patrice Fauger. Since 2019, he is clinical chair in anesthesia at the University of Aberdeen, Scotland, United Kingdom. Welcome, Patrice.
Thank you. Thank you, Ulrike. And thank you to the ESAIC for organizing this podcast.
So let's start with the first question, a very difficult one, I think. What is chronic post-surgical pain, CPSP? Is there a definition? How is it used this term in the past? Well, what are your ideas?
That's an interesting question, and probably for many of the people looking at this podcast, at this videocast, it may look like simple and complex. So, in the past, we have used various definitions, and that has created many problems for the epidemiology of pain after surgery. To be simple, the definition is now very clear, and that's in the ICD-11, so the International Classification of Disease, the 11th version of the WHO. There is a clear definition of what chronic post-surgical pain is, and that's obviously after surgery. 3 months after surgery, not a continuation of a pre-existing condition, so pain can be present before surgery, but it could appear and persist after surgery, or it could increase after surgery, persist more than 3 months. And not any kind of pain, but post-surgical pain is then in the area, or is localized to the surgical field or area of injury, but that may be also referred pain that also cover the innovation territory. But that's very important to consider these different aspects, not saying that there aren't other kind of pain and persistent pain after surgery, but when we speak specifically about chronic post-surgical pain, that's this ICD-11 definition that we should refer to.
Let's talk about the magnitude of the problem. How many patients suffer from CPSP after surgery?
Yeah, so that's a very, very significant problem. So I have mentioned the importance of the definition. If we broaden the scope of the discussion, there is a big proportion of the population who unfortunately struggle with pain. So let's think about 1 in 5 European citizens. Let's think about that. It may represent something like 200 million citizens in Europe suffering from pain in general, not necessarily after surgery. But we know that about 50% of these have seen their problems happening or aggravated after surgery. Around half of these may be or may have neuropathic components in their pain, but about half of these again just suffer from severe postoperative pain. So there are different aspects. We have to consider that the number of people suffering from pain is enormous, but the influence of the definition is also enormous on these figures and these numbers, because not all these people after surgery suffering from pain all suffer from chronic post-surgical pain according to the ICD-11 definition. That has an impact on the research agenda if we focus on a specific problem that we would like to improve by focusing on some mechanism. That has an influence also on management, of course, because the reason of the pain might be different. And that has an importance also for quantifying the problem on an epidemiological point of view, because that doesn't mean that people not suffering from post-surgical pain according to the definition doesn't or don't have a problem, but that might be a different problem. So it's just to clarify that complex debate. So the number of people is enormous. The need is clear. It's just that it's quite a complex figure.
Yes, a very interesting point. I think there are some problematic patients who have pre-existing chronic pain, either at the site of surgery or, which is also very frequent, pre-existing pain somewhere else, which has nothing to do with the type of surgery. And these patients with pain somewhere else, they have pain before surgery and after surgery, we don't change anything by the surgery. So interesting in are those having pre-existing pain at the site of surgery. And these are specific types of surgery. And these patients quite often also have a lot of pain afterwards. And which are these risk surgeries?
Yes, so that's very important because they probably need a different kind of support. And all strategies need to be adapted according to that. It would be unfair not to recognize this particular problem that some patient present and not to adapt the strategies because we have many options, but we need now to have a more personalized approach.
Yes, so this approach has, hopefully, we should start very early with this. This is before anesthesia. And I think the time point when we see from the anesthesia department the patient for the first time to talk with them about type of anesthesia and so on, this is really late. It should be possible to see in some types of surgery the patients very early.
Absolutely. And pain assessment is there essential. So in chronic pain, we now know that the biopsychosocial approach is the one that we need to adopt. And we know that the assessment should be based on the biopsychosocial approach. And in the ICD-11 classification that we have discussed earlier, there is a clear mention and there are details and it's even possible to code chronic pain and pain in general according to this model. So it's not only about intensity, it's also about psychological distress, and it's also about interference, and that cover social aspect, but that also cover physical function. And that's particularly interesting for anesthesiologists and for perioperative physicians wishing to improve quality of recovery after surgery, and that can be integrated before surgery. So before surgery, pain is not just about a pain score or presence or absence of pain, or it's just not just about opioid use or not opioid use, even if we know that it can have implications in the management. But that's interesting to try to identify the subgroup of people that may need a more comprehensive approach. We don't need long and full biopsychosocial assessment for all the patient or for all the patient with pain, but we need to have a process to have quick, simple, and effective assessment of the biopsychosocial aspect of pain before surgery, because that will have an influence on the approach after surgery. It doesn't take much time, so to reassure people watching this video, just think about pain that it's not only about pain intensity, it's also about interference and psychological distress. If we remember that, half of the job is already done.
Yes, I think it's very important. And We, all the anesthesiologists and pain experts, were very focused on pain scores on the numeric rating scale and measuring it at rest and at movement and so on and so on. But we now have learned this, that this is a one-dimensional measurement, and we have a multi-dimensional problem, and this is pain, and this is not a score which you write down somewhere, but this is how does daily living work? What about the hobbies, going to work? What about relation to other persons and so on? This is quality of life, and we have to look at this much broader approach. And this, I think, is very important to learn, yeah, for all anesthesiologists. And you are right, we have to prepare the patients, at least those at risk. And there are some risk surgeries like orthopedic surgery, joint replacement, a lot of patients with a lot of pain.
Yeah, absolutely. So the magnitude of the problem is clear. The solutions are different because patients are different and present different problems. So, for example, if we go a little bit further and think about one specific problem that we have mentioned was neuropathic pain and severe neuropathic pain, then identifying that problem properly in a bio or within a biopsychosocial approach, because that can have influence, of course, but also identifying the specificity of that pain. So being patient-specific and procedure-specific, of course, but also pain-specific, so offering a specific treatment for neuropathic pain. We can imagine the influence, for instance, of gabapentinoids, and if they are associated with side effects for some people, that can be a problem. But for some people, it may be better tolerated and better integrated. But we have to do plans with people to be sure that it does make sense to them. But being pain specific is, of course, very important. And to identify that as early as possible is important as well, because there are specific treatment. I have mentioned the gabapentinoids, for instance, for neuropathic pain. But there are treatments that are less effective, like opioids. And if we let people on the longer term after surgery not identified well, and we let that to the family doctor later on, and let people being discharged on high dose of opioids when it doesn't help well, then finally the combination with gabapentinoids might be even less well tolerated than if it was identified early, treated specifically, and by the way, also trying to prevent the consequences of that pain on quality of recovery, psychological distress, interference with physical and social aspect.
So coming back to neuropathic pain, some of our colleagues might be not so familiar with this type of pain. They think, okay, it's a neurological problem, but it's a real pain problem. Are there certain types of surgery where neuropathic pain is frequent?
Yeah, unfortunately, we know that some type of surgery are associated with a higher risk. So it's not only about patient, it can be also about type of surgery. And we know that knee surgery, breast surgery, are definitely risk factors for neuropathic pain. We know that thoracic surgery also is associated with a quite high risk of neuropathic pain. No need to mention amputation and direct important nerve lesions that can, of course, generate neuropathic pain quite directly. So we know that this kind of surgery can generates or can be associated with a higher risk of a neuropathic pain. But not forgetting, of course, the fact that in many kind of surgery, even sometimes lower risk surgery, neuropathic pain can be observed. So to make this complex and complicated problem simple, and simpler for our teams. We have a role as anesthesiologist and educator to let people know what neuropathic pain is, so to teach in the wards, to maintain or to raise awareness if it doesn't exist among surgeons, among nurses, what is neuropathic pain. There are some signs that we can target. There are some scores that we can use. And an example is the DN4 questionnaire. That's a screening tool, so that's not a real diagnostic tool because there may be false positive, false negative. But the DN4 questionnaire is an example of a tool that we can use to sensitize people and to say that there are some signs, positive and negative signs, that you may look at. If you have a doubt, call the pain team, call the anesthesiologist, call a specialist, and we can do this journey together to treat that early.
Well, you mentioned this questionnaire. There are some other screening tools also questionnaires, but the DN4 questionnaire has been frequently used. And if this is positive, then this means that it is probable that there is a neuropathic pain, but it's not a definite diagnosis. For this, we need further investigations, but it's an easy to use tool. Perhaps you can describe our colleagues the symptoms and signs which are typical for neuropathic pain. What do they say? Well, how does it feel like?
So that's quite a good opportunity to jump from this DN4 questionnaire discussion to the signs and the symptoms. And I often explain to students or to nurses that is quite easy. DN4 stands for Doula Neuropathic 4 questions. And then we have 4 big questions we may come to, and then 2 at the interview of the patient and 2 for the clinical examination. And at the interview, we may look at positive signs and negative signs. Positive signs might be direct signs of nerve lesions like burning pain, pins and needles, that kind of positive signs that are associated with neuropathic pain. Sometimes it might be helpful to use the word nerve pain for some patients that may have more difficulties to understand neuropathic pain. But positive signs and negative signs, numbness, lack of sensations in an area, and that can be also confirmed at the clinical examinations. Positive signs like allodynia, so gently brushing the pain that shouldn't be painful, and sometimes it is. That's called allodynia. And negative signs like when gently brushing again, this area or that part of the skin looks less sensitive, and that's something that can be then easily understood by the patients and easily taught to nurses and colleagues to make it possible to think about these 4 questions: interview, examination, positive, negative signs. And among the 10 items, if there are more than 4 positive, then there is a high likelihood of having neuropathic pain.
Okay, I think it is important to know whether there is a neuropathic component or not, because it has some implications. First of all, one very easy one, those patients having neuropathic pain have more functional impairment due to pain and more or less quality of life due to this neuropathic pain. But it has also some implications for treatment, or perhaps you also mentioned some drugs. Is it possible to prevent neuropathic pain or to prevent CPSP in general? There is a lot of discussions and studies out. What is the evidence to prevent it?
Yeah, so difficult question. And to make the answer simple, to some extent, we have some good treatment. Good good treatment or good intervention having shown some efficacy to modify mechanisms included in neuropathic pain development. And for instance, we know that opioids induce to some extent the phenomenon called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, and that's a phenomenon including central sensitization. And central sensitization is involved in persistence of pain and neuropathic pain. And then, does it really prevent neuropathic pain development after surgery to avoid opioids? Unfortunately, not. That's not enough. Let's be clear. So then we have to go to more intensive prevention of neuropathic pain. And we have meta-analysis showing that loco-regional may, to some extent, have an effect on the development of neuropathic pain, but very heterogeneous results, unfortunately. So maybe what might be true in some situations may not be true in others. How long the loco-regional does work, how effective it is, in what kind of situation, in what kind of clinical condition, and that directly touches on another aspect that I will go on just later, is about the complexity of post-surgical pain. But I will go back on that, and just to quickly first mention other interventions, so about to after avoiding opioids or coming with gabapentinoids, we have also some meta-analysis showing a signal that it may have an effect, but clearly the effect is not universal enough to expose all our patients to gabapentinoids around surgery to try to prevent that. So it will be more for selected patients when we have a diagnosis of neuropathic pain done early after surgery, even if we can start a process of looking at this patient carefully to be sure that we do not miss a diagnosis, that the diagnosis is not done too late. Ketamine might be another option, easier. IV lidocaine, we have some data. All these different aspects are possibly helping, but at the condition that it's reintegrated in a comprehensive approach. And then I come to the last part, which is about the complexity of post-surgical pain. It's also all about the person that we are taking care of. And it's all about a comprehensive approach and the risk-benefit ratio of all our intervention to try to promote recovery and to be sure that we are patient-centered.
So we can summarize, that's not a preventive measure we should give to all patients. This does not make any sense. We can think about some type of measures in patients we think they have a high risk to develop chronic post-surgical pain. However, there is no evidence up to now that a specific drug like gabapentinoids can really prevent chronic post-surgical pain or chronic neuropathic pain after surgery. And there are a lot of other drugs which have been investigated, like ketamine, like lidocaine, and so on. What we can say is that we should perform a very good analgesia perioperatively. And you mentioned it before, regional techniques you should use whenever possible. But there's also no absolute evidence that this really always prevents CPSP. But you should do it. You should perform very good analgesia during surgery and after surgery, and should avoid that the patient has very high pain scores perioperatively or after surgery, because this is a risk factor, having high pain scores and difficult, problematic pain management after surgery for development of CPSP.
I can't agree more. That's excellent. Patient-centered approach, tailored approach, considering that there is no magic pill or not a single medication totally solving the problem. we need to go back to the patient and to be sure that we offer the best service that we can.
And also the topic of OP-free anesthesia or OP-sparing anesthesia, you can do it. But also there is not really an evidence that it can prevent CPSP. So yes, you can use it and you can combine it with regional techniques and so on. I think the main message is that overall analgesia has to be perfect perioperatively and after surgery. And you have to look at the patient before discharge, the patient's at risk, because this is a very important time point. For instance, you also mentioned it before, the opiates. What should we do with the opiates?
So, very important part, of course, yeah. If we think about the 3 months for the definition of post-surgical pain, that means that the story can be long and doesn't stop at hospital discharge. But that's definitely a moment where we should have a look to this patient, screen this patient, and organize a follow-up to support primary care, also coordinate care with primary care, but be patient-centered first. And that means that there are different options and we need to support then these people being discharged and to support primary care to be sure that the right decisions are taken at the right time, to be sure that opiate tapering is organized, that if neuropathic pain develops, it's well screened, identified, adequately treated. That means adequately with high quality pain management, but also safe one. So we need to organize processes for that. And the opiate stewardship programs or even the pain stewardship programs have been options, making it possible to structure that and to try to improve the quality of pain management even after a hospital discharge. We have also finally to gather data and then to realistically reflect on our practice. That's very, very important because some of the most important aspects of quality of recovery otherwise are out of our scope. So we need to collect data to analyze that and to try to always improve the quality of pain management after surgery.
Yes. So I think it's important, whenever possible, stop the opiates before discharge. Sometimes it might be not possible, but use non-opiate analgesics like NSAIDs, like paracetamol, and so on in sufficient doses. And it's also okay to combine two different non-opiate analgesics. And if you have a patient reporting neuropathic symptoms directly after surgery, and this exists, there are some data out, then I think it makes sense to give a gabapentinoids, but only to these patients. But no evidence for this up to now, no studies. But if we have to if the discharge is with an opiate medication, we need a follow-up of this patient to see what happens 1, 2, 3 weeks after this.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for these important messages.
So I think it's time to summarize what we have learned from you, Patrice. So we have learned that CPSP is a healthcare problem with a significant negative influence of patients' quality of life, which means also function and psychosocial problems due to pain. We should use the ICD-11 definition, which not only addresses these pain scores, but also, as you mentioned, this pain-related functional interference and pain-related distress. There's still an open question how to document this. And CPSP is sometimes neuropathic. You mentioned about 10% of the patients. And this increases pain-related functional interference with daily living. And we have to look for this and adequately treat this. And for prevention, I think it's necessary to identify patients at risk before surgery with pre-existing pain undergoing specific types of surgery. And latest before discharge, we should know whether we have a patient at risk, those with a lot of problems during pain management after surgery. We should start tapering opiates as soon as possible. Best version could be before discharge, we stop them, but this is not always possible. And those patients at risk, I think it would be very good if we contact them or the surgeons contact them and have an appointment in these patients to look how is it ongoing with pain, what about the opiate medication and so on.
Absolutely. Many things on the to-do list, but many concrete avenues and points
for the
attendees today.
So thank you, Patrice, for your input. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the ESAIC video podcast. ESAIC releases monthly podcasts, and you can find them on the website and on various streaming platforms. And we hope that you will join us for the next video podcast of ESAIC. Thank you very much. And thank you again, Patrice, and bye-bye.
Thank you.